And welcome back. It is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Pretty happy to have in our studio Larry Krotz. Title of his book is Diagnosing, Diagnosing the Legacy, the Discovery, Research, and Treatment of Type 2 Diabetes in Indigenous Youth. It's published University of Manitoba Press. And Larry, welcome to the show. Glad to see you.
Nice to be here.
This book is powerful stuff. Way you start off is it seems to me it really dovetails nicely with the way the book flows. A doctor in Manitoba visiting a First Nations location has a woman come in, visits, who brings her child with her, and she is suspicious that this child has something. So this is an Indigenous person with a hunch. So tell us what that led to.
Well, this is you wanted me to read a bit from the book, and that's the section I'm going to read, actually. So
if that's
not to do spoiler
that's
alert.
That's a pretty good segue. We're going to ask Larry to read some of this book, and by the way, give everybody a flavor and probably prompt some question in listeners' mind. So, yeah, Larry, if you would.
Just to put it in some context, the book is a medical history, or in large part, it's a medical history of this kind of detective work to figure out what was going on in a disease that continues to unfold in dreadful and mysterious ways. But back in the 1960s, there was hardly any diabetes among Indigenous people at all. Now, it's so pervasive that the Canadian Medical Association Journal predicts that 85% of Indigenous people in Canada will have type 2 diabetes. 85% at some point during their lives. So in the 70s and early 80s, it became a disease that manifested itself more and more. But in the same way as it does in the general population, it was with people who were 40 years old or 50 years old or 60 years old. You get diabetes at that time of life. You try to manage it through diet and exercise, and if you're lucky, you can wait it out. If you're not lucky, you get some pretty dreadful complications: blindness, kidney disease that leads to dialysis, amputations of feet and lower legs, and those kinds of things. But anyway, in those years, it was a disease of older people. But in the late 80s and very early 90s, these doctors who you mentioned who were traveling into northeastern Manitoba and northwest Ontario, the book is a predominantly a Manitoba story, but there's a similar story just across the border in northwest Ontario that was handled by researchers and physicians from the University of Toronto at the time. They were encountering kids, and so you referred to the mother bringing the young girl to the nursing station. So why don't I read that part?
Absolutely.
And then we can take off from there.
Good.
We can take off from there. And
yes, Larry. This is Larry Krotz, Diagnosing the Legacy.
One spring day in 1987, Dr. Ron Mundy, a physician working for Manitoba's Northern Medical Unit, serving two communities in an isolated corner of the province's northeast, examined a 14-year-old girl who had been brought by her mother to his clinic on the St. Teresa Point First Nation. The mother had type 2 diabetes, a disease rapidly gaining ground among older people in Indigenous communities all across Canada. Mindful of her own situation, she had become concerned about her daughter's lethargy and, on a hunch, had used her own blood sugar meter to test the teenager. She was alarmed by the young girl's sugar levels and brought her to the nursing station. Mundy understood the mother's concern, but found that other than the daughter being slightly overweight, there seemed to be nothing wrong with her. Should the problem be diabetes, anyone so young would most likely have type 1, then known as juvenile diabetes or insulin-dependent diabetes. That didn't seem to be the case here. The classic symptoms for type 1 diabetes were an abrupt and dramatic onset of insatiable thirst, frequent trips to the bathroom during day and night, and rapid weight loss. Without insulin injections, the patient dies. But the girl was experiencing none of these. A month later, the mother brought in the girl's younger sister to the nursing station for the same reason, high blood sugar levels. At a loss as to how he should treat these young patients, Mundy decided to seek outside help. He sent both sisters south to the Children's Hospital Diabetes Clinic in Winnipeg, along with a letter to the medical director, Dr. Heather Dean. In it, he explained that although the family had a history of type 2 or adult-onset diabetes, the girls themselves had no significant past history other than the older one feeling unwell and drowsy, and both sisters having blood sugar levels that were very high. He told Dean that she would be interested to meet and will be challenged by these two young patients. Heather Dean, a native of Southern Ontario and a graduate of Queen's University, had by then been in Manitoba for 8 years. Initially, she worked as an endocrinology resident after pediatric training in Montreal and Ottawa. Early on, she had become interested in diabetes. It was a propitious time to have such an interest. Diabetes, both in its juvenile form and late onset or adult forms, had come to the fore of both public and, more importantly, official attention. The Children's Hospital of Winnipeg had a newly minted clinic called the DERCA, Diabetes Education and Resources for Children and Adolescents. It was set up 2 years earlier in 1985 as part of a Manitoba-wide initiative to promote education about diabetes and to treat a disease considered to be increasingly worrisome. Dean was its first medical director. The DERCA quickly amassed a patient base of 150 young people, all with type 1 diabetes. The staff monitored the patients and provided information about how to take the insulin necessary to keep them alive and what to watch for in terms of future complications. By helping young people get access to programs like group counseling and special summer camps, the program set out to support them and their families in what they knew was a challenging lifestyle. Soon, however, additional youngsters began to drop into this cohort. These new patients, a couple at first and then several more, were not white like the overwhelming majority in the Children's Hospital Clinic. They were First Nations children and teenagers with roots in the province's north. Like everybody else, they were put on insulin. But as time passed and more Indigenous kids showed up, it became apparent that these cases were not the same as the rest. The young Indigenous patients appeared to face a unique condition. They exhibited high blood sugar levels, but few of the other symptoms consistent with type 1 diabetes. Puzzled, Dean turned to her textbooks. People were saying it couldn't be type 2 diabetes because that was something you only got later in life, she recalls, looking back. But if that were the case, then we didn't know what it was. In the textbook, she found that there had been very rare cases of children with a genetic condition called Prader-Willi syndrome who showed symptoms akin to diabetes. With this condition, the patients, perpetually hungry, basically eat themselves into extreme obesity and then suffer when their pancreas fails to cope. But the children currently in front of her did not fit that profile. They had vague or no symptoms prior to diagnosis, and the high blood sugar was only discovered because someone in the family with type 2 diabetes suspected something was wrong. Many of these northern families had no running water at home and relied on an outhouse or a bucket during the winter. So had their children been experiencing extreme thirst or frequent urination, it would have been noted by the whole family. This was not the case. As well, rather than losing weight, these children were usually obese, with no recent weight loss. The physician was stumped about how to treat young persons who obviously had symptoms, although not of type 1. In one case, she recalls, though her blood sugar level was high, I did not start her on insulin or advise insulin because she didn't have any other symptoms. Instead, we advised the family about healthy eating and exercise and sent her home. In a letter back to Mundy, who at that point she had never met but had only talked to on the phone, Dean noted how she was paying special attention to the young Indigenous patients now coming into her purview. The majority, she observed, seemed to do well with dietary restrictions, but noted that management would be a challenge. The DIRCAS staff then took a second look at earlier patients. The other names for type 1 or IDDM and type 2 or non-insulin dependent diabetes mellitus were juvenile onset and adult onset. Thus far, type 2 diabetes appeared to be strictly a disease of adults, usually adults well into their 40s to 60s. This is where Dean and her colleagues needed to take a philosophical leap. A couple of young girls who had come on the scene as early as 1980 and had been treated as if they had type 1 presented all the manifestations of type 2, as did, Dean observed, the two sisters sent to her by Dr. Mundy. This was a shock, as was the realization that the Indigenous patients came overwhelmingly from the same area, a set of four isolated First Nations in the northeast corner of Manitoba called Island Lake, one of the four communities being St. Teresa Point. Even if the young people were living in Winnipeg at the time of their diagnosis, Island Lake was where their roots were. Putting these pieces together became Dean and her team's aha moment. From then on, contrary to the conventional medical wisdom of the day, the Winnipeg pediatrician came to believe that NIDDM, or what would commonly come to be known as type 2 diabetes, could show up in persons under the age of 18. The shoe dropped. If we start to look for it, she remembers thinking, we're going to find it.
That's Larry Krautz, diagnosing the legacy. Well, that captures it. The work really began, 1987 was the date of that?
1987 is the date of this. When they started to, things went in two directions. First of all, they had a hard time convincing all the endocrinology experts across the country that this was in fact what it was. People scoffed at them. They were outsiders. They said, "Oh no, this can't be. You know, this is not a disease anybody's ever seen in this manner before." So,
Did they have some other theory about what it was?
No, they didn't have another theory. But they said you've got to have it wrong. So this took the next 5 or 8 years for them to get credibility and to get published. They had a hard time getting their first publications into print. What happened on the other side of things, the Manitoba people and the folks from Toronto who were looking into things in Northwest Ontario started to link up with folks in the States, most notably in the Pima Nation in Arizona, where they were facing the same kind of thing going back as far as the 1960s. Kids who had what really looked like type 2 non-insulin-dependent diabetes, but, you know, nobody could get traction on credibility. So the people who were seeing this sort of anomaly around North America started to hook up with one another and have their own conferences. And finally got traction with the established medical community and started to get invited to, you know, the the Centers for Disease Control and places like that to come up with strategies and protocols. But it took them, you know, the better part of a decade to get credibility at the same time as they were seeing a disease that was ballooning. Because in Canada, it was initially those couple of little reserves and people across in Northwest Ontario who are actually relatives. They go back and forth, and so it's
what nation is that? It's the Cree.
They're called Oji-Cree.
Oji-Cree,
and it's a very special little corner of Cree people, where there's a mingling going back to the fur trade days of Ojibwe people from the south or Anishinaabe, and the Cree, and they have their own language and they have their own gene pool. As time went by, diabetes starts to show up in Indigenous kids all over Manitoba and all over Northern Ontario, but not until, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. And now with childhood obesity, type 2 diabetes is in kids of
all communities,
many, many ethnicities.
So you kind of think of, there's some analogies when they talked about the AIDS, people wanted to kind of say, well, it's certain people have it.
Yeah.
And therefore, this is kind of a subtext, we can ignore that, or let's just marginalize it. Then it suddenly they realize, no, wait a minute.
Everybody's vulnerable.
Everybody's vulnerable.
Yeah.
But this work, gathering data and getting the research, somebody did ring some phones and write some good letters to say, no, don't ignore this, right? Because we're gonna, somebody has to pull together the information.
Yeah, these are the heroes of the story. They're the heroes of the scientific research story and the pioneering treatment story. The other heroes of the story is, of course, the families and the communities that are enduring this and trying to get somebody to take their disease seriously, and to have so those two things are kind of there. The both on both sides of the Manitoba and Northwest Ontario border, some very deep survey research was carried out. U of T people, two of the guys who are heavily involved in it are now at Western, but a guy named Anthony Hanley at U of T spent 3 years at Sandy Lake First Nation up on the Severn River. And they said they studied every person in the community at the invitation of the chief and council.
I really liked that reading it.
And they did the same
a meeting
thing.
Of minds.
Yeah.
And there was no, oh, who are you? And no, we don't want it. And no, they wanted, both sides wanted to tackle it.
One of the conditions of the Sandy Lake folks when the U of T people went there is that you got to do research with us, not on us.
I like that. Yes, it crops up with, not on, and it comes into discussions of the truth and reconciliation, I think, which you cite three or four times in the book, and a changing, which absolutely necessary change in the relations between the, frankly, the colonializing and the those who were colonized, to involving such symbolic things as when a sporting event is the cup game in Ottawa, there was someone from the First Nation gave a speech, welcome to this is the land of so-and-so. And that seems small, but it is actually very, very important. This, because it's an, once you say that, there's a certain amount of empowerment creeps in. Because I assume the guy who says welcome might also say you're not welcome.
One could.
Or I'm not reconciled.
Well, those land acknowledgements are pretty much universal now. You don't open a meeting at the University of Toronto without acknowledging where you are and or you know the pre-contact land.
And also ties in with you bring up the World Health Organization and Aboriginal people around the world has with this problem.
Well, what's interesting. This is a major disease worldwide. I mean, the WHO says that it costs $825 billion a year. In Canada, Diabetes Canada pegs the cost of treatment and lost wages and suffering zone at $17 billion. Mm-hmm. A year in Canada. So this is a dreadful and expensive and you know, I mean, if you're a family, you've got some diabetes in it. It consumes, you know, going to your dialysis treatments and taking your medication and not being able to work and looking after granny or looking after whoever has the disease. This is what I encountered, you know, when I visited the Island Lake communities. This is what life is like there.
It's a little girl developing it. I think she was 14, maybe, and her grandmother and the girl had to look after the mother.
Yeah, yeah.
The girl didn't have time to worry about herself. She's got type 2.
Yeah,
and
so it's all consuming in that way, and across the world. It's growing, and it's growing more dramatically among indigenous populations. If you go to Micronesia, if you go to anywhere across the world, it's the indigenous folks probably, although again the jury's out on all kinds of things, but these are the folks who are experiencing in one or two generations the most radical changes in lifestyle and diet. And this is the risky end of that, and this is the cost of that. So the disease is growing across the world, but more dramatically in indigenous populations than in, you know, European populations. So that's the one thing that's happening. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's happening, though, I set out to research and write the story, believing that I was going to do a fairly straightforward medical history, and you know the part that I read is medical history, but adjacent to the medical history is a story of all kinds of really interesting and pretty radical things that are going on because of diabetes in such things as the delivery of healthcare to remote communities in Canada, the partnering that's being created between, you know, traditional healers and Western medicine.
If I could just ask you, just to give people a sense of this, you say remote. My goodness. Flying, you have to go with a Dash 8 to one place, and then you take a helicopter from there.
The Island Lake communities are...
That's a long...
Well, they're still... The Island Lake communities, they're four reserves, about 10,000 people. They only have a road in the wintertime when you go across the ice. So that's when the big semi-trucks bring in their... large items
only
in the wintertime, and that's for about 6 weeks. Only for about 6 weeks is it a good road. Otherwise, it's completely fly-in, and this impacts all kinds of things. I mean, they have nursing stations in each of the communities, but the actual physicians are itinerant physicians who fly in, stay for a couple of days each week, see their patients, and it's a back and forth kind of thing. Because of diabetes, there is a dialysis unit in one of the communities in Garden Hill. It's the only non-hospital dialysis unit in Manitoba. I don't know if Ontario has some, but that's right on site, because otherwise people would have to move, and since they can't handle all the cases, some people do, they have to move and live in Winnipeg in order to go to the hospital three times a week for their dialysis. But these sort of because diabetes is not a disease that Western medicine has been able to, you know,
magic bullet,
nail with a magic bullet. The folks have had to build these partnerships around diet, around exercise, around monitoring, around the psychology of you know, a family that's facing this hardship, or a whole community that's facing this. And so some really interesting partnerships have been built, and some really kind of outside the box thinking is happening that might not have happened without the impetus of this quite dreadful disease.
Well, some doctor in the book, I remember, he said, why are we bringing these children and their parents? We need to see them. So how is the parent supposed to take the time, and maybe just a friend of the family there, and get on a helicopter, get on a plane, come to see us, and then we send them back, plane, helicopter, back. Why don't we go there?
Yeah,
aren't we going the wrong direction?
Well, the protocols all across healthcare in Canada are still largely, if you need a specialist, if you're in one of these remote communities, or in a small town anywhere, you need a specialist, you got to come to the city, right? Mm. Whether you're going to Ottawa, or you're going to Montreal, or you come to Toronto, or you're going to Winnipeg, or, okay? And in the case of diabetes, the endocrinologists wanted to see these kids four times a year. And so in the beginning, they were flying to the city four times a year, staying a couple of days. And then, you know, part of this whole process was to say, well, you know, instead of them all coming to us, we have to go to them. And so now, twice a year, the diabetes team load onto an airplane and off they go and spend half a week in the community and see all the kids who are on their radar and look at some new cases. Twice a year, the kids still come to the city, but you know, it's gone halfway. And the other thing about it, I mean, when the doctors go, or the medical teams, it's not just doctors, and nutritionists and dietitians and nurses and exercise people and all that. You get to visit the store in the community. You get to see the layout of what's available, and you get to see, you know, you can pronounce from the ivory tower of the city, oh well, yes, you need to you need to have this much exercise and
walk a mile in my shoes
and eat this much salad.
Yes.
So you get there and you see that's a completely different ballgame. Yeah. So that's important in both directions.
We're speaking to Larry Kratz. It's diagnosing the legacy, the discovery, research, and treatment of type 2 diabetes in Indigenous youth. What about this? The word, and by the way, in a number of reports, in a number of meetings, they say, this is a legacy, if I'm using that word rightly, colonialism, that you introduce a new, different economy and different food, et cetera, and then you say this is normal. But it's obviously not. This is not the food, not the way they've been living. So, and when I say colonialism, other places in the world they have this similar problem.
Yeah, it's a legacy of colonialism in the sense that colonialism is what provoked.
And I guess the correction is overcoming colonial attitudes, which is your book is about a lot of people struggling with colonial attitudes. On one level, just fundamental disrespect or lack of respect for the people they're dealing with.
The hierarchical system of healthcare delivery is a colonial a function of colonialism in itself. Not that Western medicine is bad. Western medicine's done, you know, a lot of really good things. But when the healthcare people are looking at the way they're dealing with this, they have to think of that right off the bat. Okay, here, is this a top-down specialist to subject kind of specialist to patient kind of thing, or is this, you know, how do we shift this a little bit? In terms of, you've got, especially in the north, you've got a population who two generations ago lived largely off the land in the same way that their ancestors would have 1,000 years ago, you know. Hunt game and fish and you know, certain berries and those sorts of things to sort of shift.
What people now call the ideal diet.
Yes. Well, when the kids went to residential schools, their diet changed radically.
Oh, great. Another chapter.
That was another chapter. But they also changed. The Island Lake communities had a fishing industry that is now not nearly what it was even a decade ago. Commercial. So store-bought food, which started out with the Hudson's Bay companies as, you know, lard and tea and now is, you know, the full nine yards. So you go from high protein, small servings, probably when you're hunter-gatherer, to high carbohydrate, larger servings of, you know, the kind of food we get from stores. That does its number on your body. And so
the nurse takes your blood and says, guess what?
Well, what's interesting about this is that we mentioned the Pima people earlier in the show. The Pima in Arizona have the highest diabetes rates in the world. Adults and children with all the complications that come with that. Across the border in Mexico, their relatives who continue to live a more traditional lifestyle have very, very low levels of diabetes up till now, touch wood. Mm-hmm. So the Pima gave researchers a great
thanks
study
to the
model.
American wall and don't let them in. They were able to.
They had a study. They had a study model that was able to authenticate some of their theories.
You mentioned also the Kanawake Mohawk twig to this problem. I guess they were hearing about it, but they went to work on this matter.
They went to work on this matter. Aggressively 20 years ago with stuff in their school programs. And as far as I know, there have been no cases of early onset or juvenile onset diabetes. I was talking to the guy, you know, from Kanawagi 6 months ago.
In light of what you're telling us, that's phenomenal.
Well, it is in two ways. I mean, the Iroquois people had a different diet than the Northern Cree, though, as well, going all the way back. You know, they grew corn, they grew beans, they grew tomatoes, they grew, you know, so it was a, and so, you know, the foods of that plus the foods of contact are stretched out over a longer period of time. That may have something to do with it as well.
But adaptive,
but,
yes.
But in their school programs at Kanawagi, you know, they were very aggressive about awareness and programs of exercise and programs of diet.
I'll make sure I underline this. Type 2 is really deadly. Type 1 is bad, but type 2 is really something.
Type 1 is deadly if you don't take insulin.
Right.
Before the 1920s, people automatically, that was a death sentence.
They would just die.
Yeah. Type 2 is something all kinds of people of all ethnicities in our, I've got cousins and who've got type 2 diabetes. It's something that is developed more and more usually later on in life. Mm-hmm. You know, at 40, at 50. And again, there's no real treatment other than diet and exercise. Mm-hmm. And if you are assiduous about that, you can live with it. The complications, if you don't control it or can't control it, are pretty awful.
Well, dialysis, amputation, blindness.
Blindness, those things. And
this is what we're talking about, early onset with children.
If a child goes
through a number of years, feels fine, then it's too late.
The early onset is pretty dreadful because I encountered families, and we dedicated the book actually to a woman. Her mother was a nurse. Her mother's an indigenous person who was a nurse in the whole diabetes field. Mm-hmm. But Donna, who I didn't meet because she died in... Donna Flett developed diabetes at 14. By 25, she was blind, and by 26, she was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a happy story because it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people, they're learning a lot. They're learning a lot, and people are paying attention, and people are working hard to control it. But the numbers of people getting diagnosed, that's growing. Mm-hmm. And the kids, we go into this in the book in a fairly large way. The kids who were diagnosed in the 90s as 14-year-olds now, of course, have their own children.
Yes.
The curve is not an encouraging one.
Mm-hmm.
These kids are contacting the disease in larger numbers at earlier ages.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the bad news.
Yeah, I really urge people. By the way, you dedicated this to Mary Jane Wood and Donna Flett. There, if people were only to read that portion, it would be sobering and inform them. But you know, it's like watching a fight, and thank goodness there is one, and there is actually some transformation. And this is Larry Krotz, and his book is Diagnosing Alexei. You're a veteran. You went there you started in 1970 as a journalist. You weren't covering this, but you know about all this stuff. And you are seeing communities doing some things. So there's gymnasiums. There's teaching people how to prepare food and all that. Could you talk about that?
The guy who drove me, who was my host at Island Lake, a guy named Larry Wood, works for something called the Aboriginal Diabetes Initiative. So he's the ADI worker. And Larry took me around for several days on two occasions. I was up there twice. He took me to the high school where his program has installed a gym. And it's not a gym just for the kids in the high school. The whole community comes and uses the gym. He's got people growing gardens, and they grow community gardens, and they've got. We were driving across, down a road, and I said, "What's that over there?" And there's this kind of lopsided building. He said, "Well, that's our chicken barn." And I said, "We raised 1,000 chickens last year. They got 1,000 baby chicks. They grew them to." Mm-hmm. Full size, they slaughtered them and marketed them to the community for fresh meat. They rehabilitated the old hockey rink, which had been laying dormant for a few years, and they committed to sell only healthy snacks.
Mm-hmm.
They've enlisted the Northern Store, the grocery store, to have a nutrition corner and to give prizes for diabetes walks and diabetes runs and all this. So this is pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah. It helps with the managing, right? I mean, you have to have a conscious... getting the cooperation, particularly of young people, that takes some psychology, some they also had to be inspired. There's a lot of questions in here about anxiety, depression, other issues which grow from also out of being colonized.
Yeah, yeah.
Powerlessness.
And also, I mean...
the feeling of powerlessness.
The feeling of powerlessness. And with young people, I mean, and this, they're doing a lot of work on this, actually, as well. The psychological component of... If you feel you're different from everybody else, I've got this disease, I'm different from all my friends, you know, they're all eating chips and drinking Coke. And
you don't want them to know.
And I'm not supposed, you know, how can I not? So if you move from that to a community which embraces this as part of what's going on, then a kid who has it is not isolated, and the kid next to him who was equally isolated, now they say, oh, we got something in common, so we can fight this together. So a lot of that is very important and is what people are working on.
You know, it's very interesting. Here they are in this very remote community, et cetera. And they're actually medical experts, and they're exercise experts, their diet. They're really, you know, an interesting frame. By the way, this is a CIUT radio, and they also have a radio station, and when all these top specialists and whatnot visit, they go on the radio and people call in and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, many, if not all, Northern First Nations have a kind of a closed circuit local radio station or local TV station, and that's where you get all the announcements. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going on in the community. But yes, a lot of the diabetes education for the, you know, going all the way back to Dr. Dean's first visits north happened over the local radio and call in.
You know, in remote areas, the radio is really special.
It is.
You know, that's all that...
It's special everywhere, Phil, but no more than there.
We considered that, you know, that we're helping bring a little light. And by the way, the light we're talking about today is Diagnosing the Legacy, Discovery, Research, and Treatment of Type 2 Diabetes in Indigenous Youth, Larry Krotz. The World Health Organization says it's a problem, and you say it mounts into the billions. The people doing all this work, and there's a lot of wonderful people in this book that you did. They're even, by the way, I like the you take them through generations. The patients are going through generations, but so are the medical professionals.
Yeah. The people who started are retiring, and there's a whole new generation of researchers and clinicians.
I just wonder, is the money going to be there, and is it going to, and on this thing of reconciliation, seems to me it has to be. In other words, if you acknowledge that a lot of bad things happened, but you know, you mentioned the schools, the taking of children, and all that, and the damage that caused, and that there should be. The words are kind of empty unless you're going to lay out the dough. You know, if you damage the other guy's property, you're supposed to repair it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the red lights started to go on a couple of decades ago about how expensive diabetes was going to be, not just in Indigenous communities, but across the board in Canada. So it's a high priority and a high cost illness, a part of the healthcare system at no matter what level. Mm-hmm. It costs $107,000 a year to be on dialysis.
What? How much?
$107,000.
And how many people are just...
Lots.
They have now. They're right there in the community. They have
well,
the beds.
Well, in the community, they've got a dialysis unit that can handle 18 patients, and there's a waiting list of 25. And these folks had to move to Winnipeg to get their dialysis. So
yes, this Mary Jane Wood that you told us Mary about. Jane, Mary you Jane, visited her.
Mary Jane was one of the early children to be. She was one of the puzzles in the 80s that they misdiagnosed, and then they said, "Oh yeah, well it's got to be type 2." So She lived in Winnipeg. She was on dialysis for the last 7 years. She has 5 kids, 4 of whom have diabetes.
Type 2.
Mary Jane invited me into both her home and her hospital room several times while I was researching the book, but she passed away in January before the book went to press.
That's unfortunate. By the way, could you just remind us? You say type 1 was treated with insulin. So when they began to see symptoms or what they thought, okay, we'll give these children insulin.
Yeah.
Why doesn't it work?
Well, sometimes it works, but with type 1, your pancreas basically, its insulin producing function has to be replaced completely. With type 2, it's a little different because your pancreas shuts down in a little different way. It doesn't quite do its job. It doesn't quit completely, but it doesn't quite do its job.
Which makes insulin not helpful.
I'm not the medical guy here, but yeah. I'm just saying what people have told
Good.
Me. It's not so much a slam dunk as yeah. You know.
Well, insulin, you can't. At one point, they were giving it to them, and then they said, "Well, we don't think these kids are taking it, but they seem to be doing okay."
Yeah.
Then the doctor said, "Well, let's just see here.
Yeah.
Leave it that way."
Again, because they were treating it lifestyle-wise by eating differently and exercising. I mean, those are the tickets. But you know, try to get a 14-year-old kid to. tell them what to do and
well,
see what happens.
Exactly, particularly if you're in Winnipeg, I guess. You know, the word poverty, poor, is kind of. We have poor people's ailments. The poor actually are the most susceptible in all communities,
yeah,
are they not?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's 6 of 1.5 dozen.
We have
a lot
of very poor people who are obese, who have this other
problem. You know, do poor people get sick more often, or do sick people become poor? You know, it's. But you talked about colonialism too. The early diseases of indigenous people were the infectious diseases that came with smallpox and measles and tuberculosis that had never been seen among the populations in the Americas until Europeans arrived, and so those were the first wave of colonial diseases. This, if you want to call it a colonial disease, is not an infectious disease, but it's the next block in the wall.
Yeah. There's a very nice afterword in your book by some of the professionals that you were working with, and I'm sure they're very satisfied with this book. I hope they are. I hope there's an what do they call that? An edition that could be read online.
It's available in e-copy for your Kindle.
Is
or
that the word I'm looking for? The e-copy or
what do they call?
I forget the phrase.
Electronic books. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You can get an e-version from Amazon.
And I get the impression that they're. I don't know. I think scientific people tend to be confident they will get to manage this. But the word would be stay tuned, right?
Stay tuned.
Isn't that where we are? That's how I read the afterword.
Yeah.
Well, we will stay tuned. We've been talking to Larry Krotz, and the book is Diagnosing the Legacy, the Discovery, Research, and Treatment of Type 2 Diabetes in Indigenous Youth. And again, the author is Larry Krotz, University of Manitoba Press. I really hope everybody gets a copy of this book, and I hope you give some talks here in town. I know you've been circulating out west, and particularly Manitoba. They're interested, of course. This is their story. Larry, thanks very much for coming.
Pleasure.
This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I thank Jessica and company, and we'll see you next week.